It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we answer one of your questions in a Why Wisconsin-based segment, looking back at the Civil War era history of UW's Camp Randall. First is the Week in Washington, where we take a look at a few of the top stories in national politics. Judge Amy Coney Barrett is still on the fast track to be confirmed to join the Supreme Court. While there's mixed messaging from the president and Senate Majority Leader about whether coronavirus relief legislation could actually happen before Election Day. We'll also look ahead at tomorrow night's scheduled presidential debate. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Did you watch any of Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings? What did you think? Do you think she's right for the court? Do you approve of the Senate's timeline to get her confirmed quickly before the election? What do you think of the priority of the Senate confirmation of the Supreme Court nominee versus COVID economic relief? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lisa Mascaro is Chief Congressional Correspondent for the AP. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the confirmation process here. You've been following that. I know what is happening tomorrow.
Yes, that's exactly right. Judge Amy Coney Barrett is on a sort of fast track for confirmation. They are set to have in the Senate tomorrow. The Senate Judiciary Committee will gavel in and basically take a vote and recommend sending her out to the full Senate for the eventual confirmation vote. So the senators on the Judiciary Committee, they heard from her last week in those back-to-back hearings. People might have, you know, followed some of that, watched a little bit of it on TV or seen the highlights. After those hearings come to a close, the senators on the panel, they sort of mull their options, and then they've got a week coming back on Thursday now to take that vote. And there's really no surprises expected here. Republicans have the majority on the panel. They also have, of course, the majority in the Senate. They are expected to get her out of the committee tomorrow and then onto the Senate floor by Friday. And the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, has decided to go ahead and keep the senators here through the weekend as they run through the sort of procedural steps. Pretty much all Democrats can do is not make it easy for Republicans. They can sort of slow things down a little bit, but they cannot, under the sort of new Senate rules, stop this confirmation. And so senators are expected to be in town over the weekend, pushing through those steps, taking some procedural votes, and she should be on track for confirmation by late Monday afternoon, evening time. Could push into Tuesday if some of the Democratic stall tactics, can stall it a little bit. They will, but we're talking Monday or Tuesday. She is expected to be confirmed, and then could join the court.
What have Republicans said about the need to expedite this process, work through the weekend, and try to have it done by early next week, just a week before Election Day?
Yeah, it is really stunning. You know, never in the history here of the U.S. has a Supreme Court nominee been confirmed so close to a presidential election. And, you know, folks might remember Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died middle of last month. And President Trump was swift and wanted this nominee for a couple of different reasons. The president has talked about the need to have a justice who would rule more favorably to Republicans in an upcoming challenge to the Affordable Care Act. You know, that's the Obama era healthcare law. Republicans have been trying to, you know, repeal and replace it for the past 10 years since it was approved. They've been unable to sort of fully gut it in Congress, and they have a challenge now before the Supreme Court, which the Supreme Court is expected to hear the week after the election. So November 10th, the court is expected to take up a case challenging the Affordable Care Act. And the president has said he wants, someone on the court that would rule the way Republicans want to get rid of that law. So that's one aspect. And then, of course, just the election itself. There's a lot of discussion about this election being sort of unlike any other. There's going to be so many, you know, mail-in ballots and potentially close. And perhaps there could be challenges, legal challenges. Of course, the president has talked a lot about his concerns over mail-in ballots, though experts, you know, sort of say there's no trouble. Plenty of states do mail-in ballots. But in any case, the president has also talked about wanting to have a justice on the court who would, be able to rule on any election challenges. So, you know, the court is 4-4 split right now. It would become a 6-3 majority conservative court. I shouldn't say 4-4 split. It's the 8-member court right now. But, you know, if she is confirmed, it would become tilted to a 6-3 conservative majority. And that's in favor of some of these issues for Republicans. So they are very eager. And the president is eager, and the Senate Republicans are also very eager because, you know, Senate Republicans have had a difficult time these last couple of years with the president because they're not always aligned on a lot of the legislative priorities. But the one thing they can all agree on is getting these conservative judges on the bench. And so Leader Mitch McConnell has really used the Senate to churn out just a number of judicial confirmations. They've confirmed something like more than 200 federal judges. And of course, now this would be the third Supreme Court judge under the Trump administration. It really is what the Senate in the Trump era has become known for. And so Republicans who are fighting to keep control of the Senate in November are really banking on this this court confirmation vote to help give them a boost with voters and a boost, at the polls.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the AP, looking at the top stories in national politics this week. Some of them you can join in at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on the expedited confirmation process for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. Committee vote expected tomorrow, as we heard. Maybe a full Senate vote as soon as next Monday or Tuesday, a week before the election. What do you think about that? And what do you think about still deadlocked efforts to have COVID-19 economic relief? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's start talking about that stimulus package now. Where is that? There's a hang up, as you said, the Senate not always in line with the president. Senate Republicans aren't. This is one of those cases, right?
That is exactly right, Rob. You know, the president has become increasingly interested in securing a COVID deal. You know, they haven't passed a big package since that last one back in March. They've done some smaller packages. The boost in unemployment has run out. There was never any money for the states and local governments. You know, that money has gone. So there's just a lot of, need out there in the country, as we see the number of COVID cases rise and potential hospitalizations, potential death toll during these fall and winter months. Half or so of the Republican majority in the Senate, they have a 53 seat majority, 20 or so of those Republican senators just really are opposed to any further spending. People might remember, these are a lot of senators that came in on those conservative waves of the past elections, the Tea Party and some of these movements that, really tried to sort of scale back on the size and scope of government and government spending. They've spent a lot this year trying to help the country through the pandemic. Of course, it's an emergency like, nothing other. But now they're kind of saying enough. And so this is the crossroads they're at. The president is eager to get a deal. He has tapped Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who has been in sort of nonstop talks over the past several days with Speaker Pelosi. And, the Senate is a little bit on the sidelines here. If Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin cut a deal and the president wants it, it's really going to put those Republican senators in a difficult spot. And Mitch McConnell, the leader, told the White House this. We know from reporting that the leader told his Republican senators yesterday at a closed-door lunch that he let the president know, you know, this would divide the Senate, divide the Republicans. And it's not something that Leader McConnell wants to do. He told the president not something he wants to do before the election. So this will really be a sort of, I don't know, we're at a point now where the negotiations are kind of coming to a head. We'll see if they're able to get something. If the president signs on, it'll be a really difficult choice for Leader McConnell and his Republicans. Of course, Speaker Pelosi, you know, she has been really driving a hard bargain on this, right? You know, she kind of has a lot of cards because she has control of the House and she can bring her entire House Democrats. You know, they have the majority over there. She can bring the full weight of the House behind whatever deal she cuts. And they want a big, robust package that would just really help all sorts of Americans, housing, you know, food security, unemployment, you know, money for hospitals, money for schools, local governments. You know, we're talking like a $2 trillion plus package. You know, Republicans don't really want anything to do with that. But she's driving a hard bargain. She knows the president wants it. She knows she's got the votes in her pocket. So she does have a little bit of an upper hand on that. And, you know, we'll see if they can all get to an agreement or not. Certain Republicans say, well, she's just, you know, she doesn't really want a deal. She's just, you know, in these talks to make the president look bad. You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. We'll know here in a couple of days if they have something or not. And we're then we'll have to vote or not vote. Oh, sorry.
We're talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the AP. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions and thoughts do you have about the issues we've talked about so far? Do you think that Congress, the House, the Senate, and the White House should all get together on a new round of COVID-19 relief spending? If so, what do you want to see included? What do you not want to see? What do you think of the expedited effort to approve a Supreme Court nominee? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with AP Chief Congressional Correspondent Lisa Mascaro. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Congress should pass a new COVID-19 relief package? What do you think about the Supreme Court effort? And if the debate happens tomorrow night, as of now, it looks like it will. Are you going to watch it? What are you watching for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I am very happy with the Supreme Court candidate. I sincerely hope, and it looks like she will be appointed and sworn in. Very happy. I've been totally disgusted for the last 3 years on the investigations, the impeachment, and all the shams that have been going through the Democratic Congress. I am fed up with it, and I didn't vote for Trump last time. I'm not really a fan. I do like some of the things he's done, putting America first, that hasn't been done for a long time by our government. That said, I'm not going to send them a Valentine's card this year either. So,
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So, Mark, happy with the Supreme Court nominee. Generally, I think, Lisa, Republicans and surveys seem to suggest, at least some of them, a slight majority support for going ahead with this confirmation.
Yes, that's right. Republicans were very thrilled over the last day or so to see some of the polling come back that now a slight majority, about 51% in some of the public polls. I don't think the AP has done a poll yet on this that I have at my fingertips, but, you know, showing some support for her. You know, it is something they can hang their hat on, and they feel those that support the judge, and it really is just the Republicans, because no Democrats are expected to vote for her, feel that she, you know, was able to be a good face forward during her hearings, was able to present herself as someone you know, that Americans were okay with. You know, Democrats will say, look, you know, she hid behind a lot of her views, and she's been very publicly against abortion, very publicly against the Affordable Care Act. But when asked about those views and how she would rule, she, you know, did not answer and said, you know, she would have to take each case as it comes. Democrats aren't buying that. They say it's very clear where she stands, and she was just, you know, being sort of diplomatic, as judges often do when they are in these confirmation hearings. They say it's, you know, not part of the judicial code to sort of weigh in until they see an actual case with actual litigants, you know, on a specific aspect of the law. So, you know, that's the divide. I don't know if those numbers will hold. I think Republicans are really counting on that. They're also really counting on, you know, like I said before, this is the one thing that they can sort of bring home to voters to show that they've done. And, you know, it would lock in a conservative majority on the court for years to come. And that's something a lot of Republican senators are really looking forward to hanging their hat on.
One issue I want to get back into with the Supreme Court, there were Republicans that kind of built up the expectation that Democrats would attack Judge Coney Barrett over religious views. Oh, actually, we've got a caller who wants to bring some of this up. Paul is with us in Slinger. Paul, hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I'm very fearful of this woman. She obviously is she's a modern day female pope, and she's going to impose an archaic dogma. Women, the sovereignty of the female or the woman in this country is going to be lost, and it's very sad.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Now, Republicans are expecting to hear, I think, or at least building up that we would hear things like that from Democrats raising her Catholic background in particular. It seems like Democrats are really trying to scrupulously avoid saying anything like that. How did that all work out?
Yeah, they certainly did. You know, so there was a situation. So Judge Barrett, just to back up real quick, you know, she's been a federal judge for essentially a little over 2 years. She was appointed to the appellate court out there in Indiana in 2017. And during that hearing, before that, she was a law professor at Notre Dame. At that hearing, you know, she was asked by Senator Feinstein about her Catholic faith and being such a strong Catholic, you know, and knowing that Catholics have a strong view against abortion, you know, would that be a factor in her decision making? And, you know, the line of questioning was deemed by many to be sort of out of bounds, you know, that we don't have a religious test in this country. We don't test people on, you know, what your faith is before you can hold office. And Republicans were really coming strong at Democrats saying, oh, they're going to do this again. They're going to do this again. Well, Democrats did not. And in fact, we wrote a couple times during the course of the hearings last week that it was Republicans that ended up bringing up her faith more than ever, you know, really defending her faith and really bringing it into the conversation. At one point, Chairman Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who's the chairman of that committee, said, you know, we have an unabashedly, now I'm not going to remember the full quote, but, you know, just a woman of faith, you know, being nominated. So they really sort of turned it around and celebrated it. And Democrats just didn't go there. They just tried to keep it on the law. And I think the whole thing ended up being maybe a little bit of a wash politically, but maybe served the Republicans well in the sense that they were able to, you know, show that a conservative woman of faith can rise to this level in, you know, in federal office. I think Lindsey Graham had called her, you know, a role model for other young conservative women.
Thanks for calling in, Paul. We're talking to Lisa Mascaro from the AP, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's spend our last couple minutes previewing what's still expected to be a presidential debate tomorrow night. As far as we know right now, Lisa, it is still on.
Yeah, as far as we know, right? I think this will be a really interesting debate. Of course, you know, again, you know, in the Senate, not to focus so much on the Senate here, but, you know, in the Senate, Republican senators are just really fighting for their majority. They're at risk of losing it in large part because of the president's performance, both his debate performance and when he was tested positive for COVID, sort of a reminder of his handling of the pandemic. internal polls for Republicans just tanked. And it was, you know, for 3 weeks ago, they were just really watching the numbers plummet and really scared a lot of Republican senators that this really could be the end of the line for their majority. So, you know, I think there's always sort of a up and down in the polls and we'll see. But I think there's a lot of a lot riding on this debate, you know, not just for the president and Democrat Joe Biden as they go head to head and sort of try to win over the American public, but for these down ballot races, the control of the Senate and maybe to a lesser extent, you know, the control of the House isn't really in dispute. Democrats have a wide margin and are expected to keep control of the House. But, you know, the top of the ticket ripples all the way through these races. And so there's a lot riding on that debate tomorrow night.
And there will be some muting of microphones, I understand. How is that supposed to work?
Yeah, I'm not covering that myself, but I've seen my colleagues report there is an agreement, I guess, to mute the microphones for a couple minutes. So each person, each candidate, the president and Joe Biden, President Trump, Joe Biden can each give their response uninterrupted. And of course, we saw last time where President Trump was really talking over, you know, former Vice President Biden quite a bit there to the point where the vice president was like, you know, come on, man, or whatever that quote was that he said, you know, just stop talking. So, you know, I think the debate commission and the moderators don't want a repeat of that. Don't want it just to be a, you know, a slugfest. And so, you know, American people should be able to hear what both folks have to say and make their own decisions. And I think that seems to be what they're aiming for and seems to be what the campaigns have agreed to.
Lisa, thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Lisa Mascaro, chief congressional correspondent for the AP. We talked to her for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, including the latest on negotiations for further economic stimulus, tomorrow's scheduled presidential debate, and the hurried confirmation proceedings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. We'll review the vote to bring Barrett's nomination to the full Senate tomorrow at 4 here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we take a look at the history of UW's Camp Randall, the football stadium, and the historic site around it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, wildlife rehab is still going on in Wisconsin, even with some new challenges because of the pandemic. A DNR expert joins the show with the latest efforts and answers to your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now this week, UW-Madison's Camp Randall Stadium, mostly empty, will see the return of Badgers football. After initially canceling the 2020 season altogether, the Big Ten took several weeks to mull that decision over before rebooting things with the games kicking off this weekend. We got a question from a listener about the history of Camp Randall going back before there was such a thing as college football being played. Here's listener John Hansen.
Hi, I'm John from Madison, and I have a question for Wisconsin. I would like to know more about early Camp Randall history at the UW as a Civil War troops training ground, the person it was named after, Governor Randall, and any other interesting history events up to its modern version. Thanks. Go Bucky.
You can also join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of Camp Randall, be it Civil War era training, the Memorial Park, Memorial Arch, the stadium itself? What do you want to know about the structures, the land around where Badgers football is played? Do you have a favorite memory? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. To help answer John's question, we called up Daniel Einstein. He's the UW-Madison Historic and Cultural Resources Manager. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Before we get into the history lesson, the phrase Camp Randall could get a little confusing. I think people think of the stadium, but it actually refers to a lot of different things all in the same general area. Sort that out for us a little, please.
Well, why don't I just start by by saying that all cultural landscape stories really begin with the indigenous people who occupied this area since, 12,000 years ago after the retreat of the last glacier. And I just want to acknowledge that when Europeans migrated to this area in the early 1800s, the Ho-Chunk people were well established here. But to your question about the names of all the Camp Randall structures and properties, it was in 1861 that the federal government called upon the states to muster soldiers for the Civil War. And at the time, the governor was Alexander Randall. And he identified the former state agriculture society fairgrounds as a place for a military training camp. And that's how the name of the 53-acre Camp Randall training ground was first established. And for those of you who are familiar with Madison, that 53-acre plot extends from Breeze Terrace to University Avenue to Randall Avenue to Monroe Street. So a pretty big chunk of what is now the UW-Madison campus.
And there are... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say there are several place names that reference Camp Randall. There's Camp Randall Memorial Park, which is that green space adjacent to what we refer to as the Shell. There is the Arch, which is the Camp Randall Memorial Arch. And then, of course, there's Camp Randall Stadium, which folks have come to use the more informal reference of Camp Randall, but it's really Camp Randall Stadium.
Well, let's get into our little listener's question a little more. You referenced the creation of Camp Randall, this 50-plus acre Civil War Union soldier training ground. Talk us through the history of that site, what happened there over the course of the war.
So Camp Randall is a military training ground, lasted for 4 years from 1861 to the end of the war in 1865. Over 70,000 Wisconsin troops moved through the camp, sometimes as many as 5,000 people at a time. And that was fully three quarters of all the soldiers that Wisconsin provided to the Union Army. So a really significant military establishment here in Madison. By the end of the war, there were 40 barracks, a hospital, officer quarters, stables, a commissary, everything that you can imagine would be necessary to support up to 5,000 people at a time. One of the stories that is particularly interesting to Camp Randall is the period in 1862 when 1,200 prisoners of war, Confederate soldiers, were brought to Madison and were housed at Camp Randall. And during that period of just over a month, it wasn't very long at all, 140 of the soldiers died mostly from disease and wounds prior to their capture. And those soldiers were buried in Forest Hill Cemetery just here on the west side of Madison. That created the northernmost Confederate burial ground in the country. At the end of the war, the property reverted to a state agricultural fairground, and eventually the state of Wisconsin purchased it in 1893.
And as the agricultural fairground, if I understand correctly, we had state fairs on that site at a few points in history.
Right. Actually, before the war and after the war, there were state fairs, as well as other major public events like the circus. So the property that became the training ground served many functions, including just agricultural functions as a pasture. And for a while, in the early 1890s, The property was used as one of the first pharmaceutical gardens for doing research on medicinal plants. And so it's interesting to note that back in the early 1890s, the university was doing research on a plant called cannabis, looking at the early medicinal values of that plant.
Talking to Daniel Einstein, UW-Madison's Historic and Cultural Resources Manager, and answering one of your Why Wisconsin questions about the history of Camp Randall, the stadium and the historic site, including the Civil War training ground that is in that part of Madison. Now, Daniel, you mentioned the Memorial Arch. Can you talk about efforts after the Civil War, in some cases well after the Civil War, to memorialize the Union Army soldiers who trained there?
Sure. So as I mentioned, it was 1893. It was 28 years after the end of the Civil War, and the property was being considered for residential development. And the veterans approached the state and said that wouldn't be right to convert these hallowed grounds, this place where so many Union soldiers were both mustered in and left. Military service. And so they convinced the state to purchase the property, and it was given to the university for their use, for their exclusive use. The university built the first building on the old training ground in 1909, a forest products lab. So the first rendition of the forest products lab was right there on University Avenue. It's now called the Materials Sciences Building. And in 1895, the first football game was played on the field next to the agricultural fairgrounds grandstand. So this was a field that dated to exhibitions during the fair period. And that would have been located where Engineering Hall is right now. That was 1895 was the first football game in what we now refer to as the former Camp Randall training ground.
And we better not let you go, Daniel, without finding out when something like the modern stadium ended up being there for football.
Sure. So the old grandstand had problems. The bleachers collapsed, and in 1917, the money was allocated to create a new stadium, and the first concrete seating structure was built into the side of Breeze Terrace, that slope on the side of the west side of Camp Randall Stadium. And then subsequently, there were many additions made to the stadium. And now, of course, it can accommodate up to 80,000. But initially, it was just a few concrete bleachers on the side of the Breeze Terrace Hill.
Daniel, thanks so much for sharing this history with us today.
My pleasure.
Daniel Einstein is the UW-Madison Historic and Cultural Resources Manager. We talked to him today about the history of UW-Madison's Camp Randall, including the Civil War training ground and Confederate prison camp there. And this conversation, by the way, was inspired by a question from listener John Hansen in Madison as part of our Why Wisconsin project. You can submit your own question. We might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. We'll keep things going coming up and look at the college football era of Camp Randall Stadium and share some memories with the voice of UW-Madison football and basketball. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember your first time seeing a Badger game at Camp Randall Stadium, your first season opener? Do you have a favorite memory? Did you play there? Or did you play an instrument there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the history of Camp Randall. We just went back to the Civil War era. Now we'll check out some more recent stories from the UW-Madison football stadium. There's the traditions, a jump around, the fifth quarter, great moments for the Badgers football team, maybe just the incredible fall and winter days spent outdoors as part of the wave of spectators. You could join in if you'd like, if you have a memory you'd like to share at 800-642-1234 or a question for our guest, the voice of UW-Madison football and basketball for that matter. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Here's a memorable football moment. October 16th, 2010, number one Ohio State came to Camp Randall for a night game.
For the first time in 13 years, a top-ranked team comes to town. Kick is in the air. Gilreath will have an opportunity. He'll catch at the 3. Between the hash marks, 10. Slicing left, 15. Across the 20. 25-30. Gilreath to the 40. He's to the 50. Foot race to the house. At the 30. At the 20. 10. 5. Touchdown, Wisconsin. And this game is underway with a bang.
That was the voice of Matt LePay, who is the voice of UW-Madison basketball and football. He joins us now. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be on with you.
Well, you've seen so many games there. Do you have a first memory, your first encounter with Camp Randall Stadium?
A first or a favorite?
Let's hear both.
My first is kind of a contrast in emotions, I guess, from a fan's perspective, because I grew up in Ohio and I moved here in 1988. And my first game at Camp Randall Stadium, there were about, I think, 36,000 fans in the stands, which meant there were about 40,000 empty seats. They had a very tough year that year. They only won one game, and the first game I went to wasn't one of them. They lost to Western Michigan. So that whole season was a bit of a mess, to put it mildly. The favorite, there are three that stand out. You just played a highlight from one of them, but I think if I was to be asked my single favorite memory, I think for me, and I would imagine a lot of fans would be inclined to agree, would have been in November of 1999, the day that Ron Dayne set the NCAA career rushing record. Middle of November, it was about 70 degrees, like it always is, right? The middle of November,
right, yeah.
Here in Madison. And the day was perfect. Wisconsin had clinched another Big Ten championship. The Badgers routed an Iowa team, a rival, a longtime rival, and Ron set the rushing record. If I was to narrow it down to one, that would be the one.
Let's talk about the space here. You've done, obviously, home and away games. You've had a lot of opportunities to compare and contrast. What, to you, is special about Camp Randall Stadium?
Well, I just think the environment in the stadium and around the stadium, which we obviously cannot have this season for the obvious reasons. But I think just the party atmosphere, the festive atmosphere. Football is very important to people here, but it's also the social aspect of it. I think Badger fans, they take their team seriously, but generally speaking, they know where to draw the line. It isn't win a national championship or bust. It's have a great time, take great pride in your school, in the athletes who represent the university and represent the state of Wisconsin. I think that to me, I think Badger fans have, by and large, done a great job of separating. It's important to see their team win, but it's not the be-all, end-all. And I think that's the one thing. And jump around and the fifth quarter and everything that goes into it, it's more than just the game. But the fact that the team has been good far more often than not for the last 25-plus years, it certainly added a lot to it. And knowing that in most cases, nearly every seat is going to be full.
Well, and you've gotten to witness what a lot of people in the state have witnessed, the team going from, I don't know, maybe a lovable loser persona for this football team to a consistently team that people have to think about, even if they're not at the top of the Big Ten. Any given year, they could be in contention. Can you talk about that transition?
Yeah, it went from, lovable loser is one way to put it. I think people, the team was in such dire straits there. There's always going to be a certain amount of fan anger, and then it just turned into apathy. People just wouldn't come to the games anymore. And then Barry Alvarez arrived. Donna Shalala, the chancellor, she understood that it's not a bad thing if your football team is really good and bringing in Pat Richter as the athletics director, a true Badger in every sense of the word, one of the great people that I've ever met in athletics, no matter the level. And then the hiring of Barry Alvarez, who he had, you know, the famous line in his introductory press conference, you better get your season tickets now because before long you might not be able to, which seemed like one of the most arrogant statements in the history of college football. But it was the attitude that Wisconsin had to have. You had to have somebody come in here and say, you know, Wisconsin can be a winner. And he did an off the charts great job in elevating the program to the level it has been at now for more than 25 years. And I always tell people that if the worst thing you can say about your favorite team is they have a chance every time that they play, that they at least have a chance, that's a pretty good thing, because there were a number of years here where you really couldn't say that. But the Wisconsin program has been good enough long enough that when in doubt, you still think every time they step on the field, no matter who it's against, that they have a chance.
Talking to Matt LePay, voice of Wisconsin football and basketball, looking at the history of Camp Randall, the stadium, the site, and the team that plays there. And Matt, I got to ask, you know, I grew up listening to Ernie Harwell calling the Detroit Tigers games. Always been a fan of sports broadcasters. Doing live radio, I even more appreciate the job that you guys do. What goes into preparing for any given Saturday, I guess, for you?
Yeah, that's the key word there is preparing, preparation. When I talk to younger broadcasters, I make the loose comparison, you're studying for a test. And the more efficiently, the more effectively you study, the easier the test should be. You want to make it as a broadcaster where the game is fun, because there's a lot of traffic that we have to get in during the course of the game. We have a lot of sponsors. We want to make sure that we give them the recognition that they deserve and maintain the mechanics of the game, the score, the time, where's the ball, who has the ball, who made the tackle. So it's a lot of memorization. I've been going through the Illinois roster this week. And just talked to my counterpart who calls the Illinois games, talked to him earlier today, just comparing notes. And you get as much background information on the players as you can, keeping up to date all the time with the Badger players, talking to a few players every week, meeting with head coach Paul Christ at least twice a week. So you just gather as much information as you can. So in this case, when Friday night rolls along, that it should be fun. You know, there's always the unexpected, right? They expect the unexpected, but the better the grasp you have on the material, the Wisconsin roster, the Illinois roster, in theory, the easier and the more enjoyable the broadcast should be.
Is it going to be possible to keep up that fun factor at the game without the fans and the stands going nuts?
Yeah, it's a little different. I have some experience with that now, filling in with the Milwaukee Brewers, their television broadcast, doing a couple of dozen games. It's definitely different. You notice it when you walk in to an empty ballpark or here an empty Camp Randall Stadium. You're not going to have that pregame hype when you're driving into the stadium. There's not going to be game traffic, right? But I think when the game starts, at least in my experience, you're locked in to your job. And in this case, it's describing the game for a radio audience and try to be as detailed as you possibly can. I find it in a lot of ways more awkward to watch or listen to a game without a crowd than it is to actually work a game without a crowd, because you're just occupied with the things that you need to do to execute a broadcast.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Matt LePay is the voice of Wisconsin football and basketball. We talked to him today about some memorable moments in Camp Randall Stadium, which will host Badger football again this week for the pushed back opening of the 2020 season. Earlier, we talked about some Civil War era history of the grounds of Camp Randall. It all comes from a Wisconsin question from listener John Hansen in Madison. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin if you want to ask your own question. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Senate committee is scheduled to vote on a new Supreme Court nominee. A successful vote sends the process to the full Senate. We'll get the latest on the politics behind the vote. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. For a lot of us, holiday memories include Charlie Brown and Peanuts TV specials. But good grief, they may be harder to find this year. Starting with the Halloween special, it's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. Central Time producer Bill Martins alerted me to the news. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Rob.
All right, so what's going on with our Charlie Brown specials now?
Okay, so the production companies that are associated with Peanuts struck a deal with Apple TV Plus, which means that that's where you're going to have to go if you want to watch the Peanuts specials, including the Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas specials. So this will be the first time since they came on in the 60s that they're not going to be on broadcast TV.
Well, I think for a lot of fans who count on watching this every year, it's going to feel like they got a rock in their Halloween sack.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there is a little bit of good news here. You're not totally out of it if you don't have Apple TV Plus, which is a paid subscription service, by the way. They are making the three specials available for a couple of days around the actual holiday. So, like, next weekend, you'll be able to watch the Halloween special. The Thanksgiving one will be on around Thanksgiving. And then I think the Halloween special is actually going to be available for free for a couple of weeks before Christmas. So you're not totally out, but it is different.
And you watched it on DVD real quick, right?
We did. My wife and I watched the Halloween one on DVD last night, and it's not the same. It's got to be a TV event, man.
With those very specific Zinger ads. Bill, thanks a lot.
All right, see ya.
This is Central Time.